Hey, everybody, welcome to the Daniel Davis Deep Dive Intel Briefing, where we give you the best of what was discovered this week, things that you need to make sure that you get. And by the way, you can share with your friends. Be sure and like and subscribe this if you haven't already. Also, we are on Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, and really anywhere you get your podcast, just type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You'll find us there, because don't sit on this stuff, folks. You're going to get some great stuff, as you're about to see in this episode. Share it with other people so that we get this truth, this unintimidated, uncompromised truth out there to everywhere. We were kicked off this week with Larry Johnson talking about what happened between Russia and United States last week in Moscow.
It wasn't so much discussing the particular issues. It was Russia saying, okay, look, these are our non-negotiable points. These are the areas where we think we can have discussions. But one of those points is we're not going to sit down with Zelensky. And we're not going to sit down with Zelensky. Ukraine has got to have a legally authorized representative. And then we can make progress in talks with Ukraine, but not until. So this is all this beginning to, it's lining the orchestra up. It's distributing the sheets of music, but they haven't started playing the symphony.
One of the other things is that you said is important, who wasn't at this meeting too, Sergey Lavrov. And I wonder if you could explain that.
Yeah, when he was at Bishkek, held a press conference, he was asked about the negotiations. And he basically said, look, there's a process here. And a critical element of that process is Sergey Lavrov. The foreign ministers got the lead on this. And then the others that will participate will be Medinsky, who has been up to this point the one that met with Ukrainians twice in Istanbul earlier this year, and Ushakov, who's the national security advisor to Putin. But Putin made a point that those three, when those three are involved, that's when the whole actual negotiation is underway. So that's why what this meeting with Witkoff and Kushner, it's just prep. And I think it's prep more to get them in a position where that they can fully help President Trump understand the inflexibility of Russia on certain of these terms.
Now, that was one of the big issues that I think we had definitely learned during this week, is that while it was a good meeting in terms of, and actually quite substantive, it was 5 hours long. There was a lot of things that were discussed, and apparently many things that were not just related to the Russia-Ukraine war, but actually on the other side. This is a common theme that we've seen ever since Trump has been in office, that every time Putin gets involved, he likes to talk about things on the other side of the war. He's talking about economic issues. He's talking about strategic issues, nuclear arms reduction treaty issues, et cetera, because they want to view this thing in the context. And so we get to the situation again to where there was nothing announced afterwards. And Larry really kind of set the stage for explaining to us why that was, that this is just going down the road further of saying, here's where our position remains. I was going to say, here's where it is, but we already know where it is. Russia has communicated where it is. They have actually said after the Alaska meeting that nothing had changed, and that they were kind of wondering why nothing happened after that meeting. And we'll wait to see if anything's going to happen after this meeting. But I think, again, President Putin made very clear where their positions are. And I think the fact that, as Larry pointed out, why Sergey Lavrov, the foreign minister, was not there, why U.S. Secretary of State was not there, was because this was basically kind of a working level situation, if you will, between Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who was also there, by the way, about business issues. And he certainly isn't there to talk about the activities on the front line. So that was also kind of a tell about what this meeting was about. And the fact that the Russians didn't talk about it afterwards and the United States didn't talk about it afterwards, I think buttresses Larry's suggestion here that this was a stage setter and getting the sheet music set, as he said, so that maybe they can come to an agreement later. So what's going to really be the issue is what's going to happen in the coming days and in the near-term future. Meanwhile, as we keep talking about virtually every time we mention this, Russia has not changed anything on the front lines. They are continuing to move forward. And even in the course of this week, there's continued to be additional advancements on the front line by Russia. The Ukraine side is attempting some counterattacks, especially up in the Kupiansk area. They've had some moderate tactical success there, but this is going to end up like every single one of the other counterattacks that the Ukraine side does. They sometimes, if they can mass enough troops together and firepower, they can have limited impact, and then they're going to lose it back. That's just the way it's going to work, because the dynamics are irretrievable and irrevocable on the Russian side. And so all it's going to do is get more people killed. It will not change the outcome, probably won't even alter the timing of it, because once they start falling back, as was the case in every one of the other places they've tried this, it's as though it never happened. And I think this is going to be the same way here too. That's what was going on between the United States and Russia. Then we shift to Patrick Henningsen, who was going to tell us about what's going on in the European level, who was not very happy to not be at that meeting.
As from the beginning, Ukraine can rely on the fact that Europe will remain the strongest and most steadfast partner. We all know that we can never match the sacrifice of the Ukrainian people, but what we can match is their stamina, their resolve, their staying power, and we can equip them with the means to defend themselves and to lead peace negotiations from a position of strength. And since pressure is the only language the Kremlin responds to, we can also dial it up. We have to increase the costs of war for Putin's aggression, and today's proposal gives us the means to do this.
I think it's just total political bluster talking to, I think, a brain-dead media that are also complicit in this whole charade. Is the European media, as well as all of the European politicians, everyone waving their Ukraine flags for the first couple of years. And you can notice they're not, there's no Ukraine flags on their European Parliament flag holder thing by their seat in the parliament anymore. It's not happening. Everyone's looking for a way to sort of get off this. But here's the thing, Danny. You know, Washington can wash their hands of this, still profit from it, because now they have almost a monopoly on LNG going into Europe, you know, US and some of the, you know, Qatar as well. So, but Europe's going to have to wear this. They're going to have to wear the shame and the failure and the humiliation. There's no way around it now. I think there's a ball has been set in motion. Even if this takes, you know, a year to resolve, or 2 years to resolve, or whatever, that this is, to me, is just such a catastrophic defeat for NATO and for Europe politically.
Now, one of the things he mentioned there at the outset of that clip was, he said, this is just another example of the poor job of the Western media, et cetera. I'm putting a little asterisk on that, because I'm going to show you something here later in this this episode right here, where part of the explanation for why that is was demonstrated on, let's say, on Friday. So yesterday, there was something released by Sky News. So kind of like a little teaser on something that's coming here. The media is not entirely to blame, as we kind of, as I have thought up to this point. There's still some blame to go around, but you're going to see why some of these people are so misinformed. Now, I'm not sure you can say the same thing by Ursula von der Leyen, because she is the president of the European Council, and she is supposed to be selected for that position because she can independently make assessments of things. It can say things, what's logical, what's not, what's rational, what's not, whatever's being told to her. She didn't seem to be doing that, because a couple of things there, he says, you know, pressure is the only thing that Russia understands. Well, Russia understands a lot of things. Pressure is one of them. And if you can bring enough pressure, you can actually have some influence here. That's just human nature. It's not necessarily limited to Russia or anybody else for that matter. But when you have tried something, you know, one time, two times, three times, 12 times, 19 times, and you don't get a reaction, you don't get a response that you're looking for, and all the time you're trying these 19 iterations of something, sanctions, and you see that your side continues to get undercut, it might be a good idea to get off the bridge or to get off a limb that you're having chopped out from under you and thinking, no, I just need to go a little further out on this limb, a 20th round of sanctions. That's kind of where, I mean, I'm mocking that, the ridiculousness of it, but that's not a mocking trend. That's actually what we're doing, and that's what the European Union is doing. That's what Ursula von der Leyen continues to brag about. And, you know, and it says, yeah, we can keep dialing it up. I mean, that's the same thing. Dial it up with what? I mean, literally, they're about to try. They're getting ready for their 20th round of sanctions. And you got to ask the question, which unfortunately very few in the media do, so they do deserve blame for this one. If you've failed at 19 times, are you trying to tell me that after, and we'll just pick a number here, the 16th one, and certainly the 19th one, that you had other sanctions on the table, there were other cards you could have played, and you just chose not to? So you're trying to get an end, you're trying to put pressure to get them out there, and you just chose not to do that? You just went a little bit of the way? Because if you didn't, then the question is, why do you think that whatever you are finding and going to try to insert for number 20, why would it? Why did all those things not work in the previous rounds? And of course, they're oblivious to the fact that the reason that Russia is not being is being something close to impervious to this is because of all these first rounds, which had, in many cases, biting impact and really did hurt the Russians. And especially in 2022, in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, there was some really stinging hits on the Russian economy. They had to really do some retool. It took well over a year to get a lot of this retooled. But then, as a product of that, they found new industries. They found new markets. They found new customers. And now their orientation has gone way from the West, much more to the East even than it was before. And more on this later in this episode too. India is a big part of that. And Russia continues to deepen its ties with both India, China, North Korea, Iran, and the global South and other partners in Asia and other parts of the world. So all because of these sanctions that we've been putting on them, and you can, there's thousands of sanctions that we have. Well, never take anything off. And by the way, just kind of as an aside, sanctions are only useful in the event that you want to coerce somebody and to compel them into taking some behavior that you want. And putting sanctions on is not really the coercive issue. The issue is in taking them off. Because if you see a side realizes that if they concede to whatever behavior or policy that you want, if they see that there's a benefit that the sanctions will come off and the money will start flowing again, then you have created an incentive and a motivation for them to do as you want. But when all you do is levy one sanction after another, one round after another, then you show the other side, they become convinced that there is no point in working with you because they're only coercive and punitive measures, never the taking them off. So you lose any kind of leverage that you have. It's just basically a punishment to spanking. And that's all it's a return. So now then you take off the table the possibility that they're going to comply with anything because you only want to take. That's kind of what we're doing. And that's part of what Patrick Henningsen was talking about there, how the disconnected from reality these folks are, because they are literally cutting down the branch upon which they're leaning further out over. So then I mentioned to India, there was a big meeting, and this that may also have been, I almost certainly was part of the calculations that Putin was making when he was meeting with Witkoff and Jared Kushner, is that he knew they had this big summit coming up with India. Now, just as a stage setter here, as a reminder, we currently have 50% tariffs on India, 25% of which are because they are buying Russian oil. When Trump earlier this year threatened all these tariffs and massive secondary tariffs on all these different countries, and China being one of them, the only one he actually employed them on was India. And they're still there to this day. We've been continuing to work a lot of bilateral things to try to get that back off and try to figure out some kind of negotiated settlement that's a win for both sides. It's going to keep you India on our side. But so far, we haven't taken that off. And we still are trying to coerce India to cut ties with Russia. Well, I think that let's first of all look at the Putin end of that. He was talking to his interlocutors there and the Indian media, and he took that opportunity to share his view of how this war even started.
We did not start this war. The West condoned, facilitated, and organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine. After that, events began in Crimea, and then events started in the southeast of what was then Ukraine, in Donbas. You know, no one talks about this. For 8 years, we tried to resolve these issues peacefully. We signed peace agreements in Minsk, hoping that to resolve this problem by peaceful means. Then it turned out that Western leaders, they said this publicly, never intended to fulfill the Minsk agreements and only signed them to give Ukraine time to arm itself and continue the armed struggle. After 8 years of people being killed in Donbas, we were forced to act. For some reason, no one in the West, no one talked about this. Not a word is mentioned about it. We were forced first to recognize these republics and second to begin supporting them.
So now when Putin says this kind of thing in the West, it's immediately just mocked and just he's ridiculed and said none of that is true, etc. even though much of it is factually accurate. They did have the Minsk Accords. They did sign these agreements. They were conducting negotiations. They did not send their military into the Donbas area prior to February 2022. Those things are all true. So whereas in the West, they just get categorically and reflexively mocked and dismissed without giving a second thought to, other parts of the world, they're not quite so dismissive. And when people start looking at that and they think, here's what President Putin is saying, here's what Ursula von der Leyen is saying, and their ilk and their like, and you're going, now, compared with what they're saying, and you look at the framework of what has actually happened on the ground, you look at the realities here, seems like this one's closer to reality. See, this is the kind of stuff that could come back and bite us in the butt, and already is. Because others around the world are seeing that when you hear the West speak and when you hear the Russians speak, instead of reflexively thinking that the Russians are lying and exaggerating and trying to pull the wool over your eyes, you're starting to come to the conclusion that many in the West are so divorced from reality that why would you listen to anything? And now then, and for decades, that wasn't the case. To decades, it was the opposite, that if the West said something, it was almost categorically and reflexively agreed to and listened to and believed. And it was never fully true, of course, but by and large, it was not even since out of a sense of morality per se, as much as it is that, well, it's if you're on the right side of things, it's easier to tell the truth. And if you tell the truth and then you have the power to back it up, then there's reason for people to listen to you and to act in accordance with what you want. And we did. We saw that around the world, all over the world. Lots of people willingly would buy American debt, for example. And so we had this, even though we, after Bretton Woods in 1971, we went off the gold standard, but because we had the power standard, the economic and military power, that worked for the fiat currency, for the dollar being. That's why it was so solid, because everybody recognized the stability and the credibility of the United States and the power of the economy and the military. Now then, that's weakening significantly to the point to where now some of these countries, you know, that's one of the reasons why BRICS is growing so much. It's been around for a long time, but now I think 2009, but now then in just recent years, it's starting to really gain momentum because there's starting to be a lot more questions about we in the West. That's a lesson we need to be, it's a little overtime to learn, but we better learn before it's too late, if that's even possible. All right, so that was the Russian side. Let's go to the Modi side, because a lot of eyes were going to be on how the Indians would respond to Vladimir Putin. You know, how would he be resolved? And man, look at some of these videos showing here. I mean, we always brag about Volodymyr Zelensky and how he's really good at media, and they always have these kind of movie scenes that they have. Well, looks like Indians are been watching from some of his handiwork there, because man, this is worthy of any kind of a movie that you'd see in Hollywood. I mean, they got the slow motion stuff, they got the dramatic movement here. If we could play the music, you'd be hearing some of that in the background. But you see that they are rolling out the red carpet and all the fanfare, and they had some great weather. When Putin got off the plane, Modi was out there personally to meet him at the plane. There was, you know, big smiles, hugs, all that kind of stuff. So the message was, is Trump going to be successful at putting pressure on India to get them to cleave away from Russia? Could Trump and the West put a wedge between Russia and make them stop buying Russian oil and cut that off, because the West is just absolutely excited about any possibility of putting a barrier between Russia and India, so that they won't buy the oil anymore from Russia. They'll buy it from somebody else, which will then cut off a major source of energy for Russia. Now, Russia is obviously equally aware of the significance of that, and so they need to court India to make sure that that doesn't happen. So as we look to see what was Modi going to say, any kind of indicator he might give to where he's coming down on this line, here's what he had to say.
Friends, yesterday and today, you have had very useful and meaningful discussions. I am happy that all areas of cooperation between India and Russia are represented in this meeting. First, in the area of logistics and connectivity, President Putin and I emphasized realizing the full potential of our connectivity. We are committed to moving forward on either the ISTC or the Northern Sea Route, Chennai-Valdives Corridor. Progress will be made soon. This will reduce transit time, lower costs, and open up new markets for business. With the power of digital technology, we can integrate customs, logistics, and regulatory systems into virtual trade corridors. Our goal is not limited to increasing mutual trade. We want to ensure the well-being of the entire humanity. For this, we have to prepare lasting solutions to global challenges. India is fully prepared to walk shoulder to shoulder with Russia in this journey.
Let's start with that last one there, because he talked about a lot of economic issues, a lot of trade, some tourism was in there, etc. But he camps on that last part there about any kind of global challenges that may be out there, and that we will stand side to side, shoulder to shoulder with Russia and Vladimir Putin. Don't think that message was missed on anybody in Washington. Well, I doubt that it was. I mean, let me not give too much credit. Shouldn't have been missed by anybody in Washington, because you're talking about the deals, first of all. And if you were asking, if you were hoping, having any idea that there would be a wedge put between New Delhi and Moscow, those were immediately undercut. I mean, first of all, by the imagery that was shown there. So they were lavishing, you know, all of this state visit and just rolling out the literal red carpet. And then, you know, they're talking about, we're looking for to develop the full potential of our economic relations. There was 10 separate deals, I think, that were eventually signed between the two leaders before they left. Some trade barriers were going to be removed, new corridors for trade. There's a lot of tourism, apparently was a big issue between the two sides. They were really interested in that. And then you saw that deal right there with the shoulder to shoulder with any international challenges that may occur. So, certainly there was no mention made that we're going to reduce the amount of oil that we buy. And listen, it was a foolish thing for us to ever require India to do that, think that they were going to. Because when this war kicked off, because of all the sanctions that the West put on there and cutting off the oil that was being originally sold in gas to European and to Western outlets, well, now then that got cut off in large measure, not all the way, but in large measure, it was certainly significantly reduced. Then India picked up the slack there. Now, it was a great deal for India, because now then they got discounted crude. So instead of just buying it on the open market and paying market prices for it, which they had been doing, they were able to greatly expand how much oil and gas they were buying from Russia, and it significantly reduced prices. And so now then here comes Trump asking Modi to say, hey, how's about you stop benefiting your country to that, you know, all that degree there, and start paying more money going somewhere else? Wouldn't that be cool? Because that's basically what we did with Europe. Do you realize that? And getting all these sanctions on Russia so that the cheap Russian oil and gas doesn't come through like the Nord Stream pipelines anymore or any of the other routes. Now then they're buying LNG from the United States. It was ironic, if not perverse, for European outcomes. You had Ursula von der Leyen this past week was bragging about the energy independence from Russia, not mentioning the energy dependence they now had on America, especially in the LNG, the natural gas, which comes at a substantially higher price, because instead of just coming through pipelines, it actually has to come via ships. And of course, there's a lot of transit issues involved with all that, etc. So now then, you're basically harming yourself, and Europe is doing it, and they continue to do it here, except for somebody like Slovakia or Hungary with Viktor Orban. They have been adamantly opposed to that from the beginning. We'll see where that goes. But bottom line is, India was not willing to follow that path, and so there's no evidence that they have any incentive to do something that would be harmful to their national interests. They don't like these tariffs, and many of the commentators that I was on one of the Indian CNN shows, and they said, listen, we are not wanting to alienate anybody. We don't want to, you know, go pro-Russia or pro-America or pro-China. We have our issues with all of them. We want to be independent actors and just be able to do business with anybody that's going to be beneficial to our country. And right now, because of our action to drive a wedge between them and Russia, we're actually pushing them closer together. Well done on that. Good job, guys. I mean, I guess that's, I don't think that was what you intended, but that's certainly what you have accomplished by the short-sighted actions that we've taken, which were entirely predictable. Wouldn't have been hard to figure out. Okay, moving on to that. One thing that happened on Friday, this happened late on Friday afternoon, and I just had to do a double take when I saw this and watched a little bit of the video. I mentioned earlier in this episode here that Patrick Henningsen had mentioned some of the problems with media, right, and some of the things they say. We say that several times about why do people just repeat these things that are self-evidently untrue. Well, part of the reason is because they're told things in private They're told things by intelligence folks, and they're told things by senior leaders, military leaders. And one of those is General Sirsky, the commander of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, who's been in office for, I think, a couple of years now. And he had an interview that was on Sky News, and to their credit, they ask a lot of hard questions, and great for that. But his answers to things were just stunning, and the absence of follow-up is indeed, unfortunately, part of the problem here. I'm going to do a show on Monday that's going to show, because there's a number of things he said there, which to me were just stunning and shocking, given the reality that we know of what it actually exists on the ground. But there was a couple things in particular he said. I want to show you one, and then I'm going to talk about one other on the backside. Watch this.
Our strategy is to exhaust the Russian army as much as possible, prevent its advance, hold our territory, while simultaneously striking the enemy in the near rear, the operational depth, the deeper into Russia itself, with the aim of undermining its defense capability and industrial capacity.
So, if you're tracking what he said there, it sounds plausible, because you're talking about we are going to exhaust Russia. We are going to make them spend so much money and so much troops on taking any territory here, they will eventually be worn down and they will no longer be able to conduct their operations, i.e. we're going to wage a existential war that is an attritional-based war, and we're going to win. The side with the smaller manpower pool, the side with the smaller industrial capacity and limited help from the outside, is going to conduct, by design, a war against a much larger country that has tens of millions of more potential troops from whom to draw on, for men that they can draw, and a near unlimited defense industrial base, and dwarfs it by many sizes over and is protected well outside. That's his opening premise there. And then to try to justify that and to rationalize it, he says, you know, and what we're going to do, it's not just on the front line, but then we're going to systematically weaken their ability across the front by these long range fires that we have, a lot of the domestic stuff we have, some of the storm shadows and some of the ATACMs that the United States has, and we're going to slowly just grind it down to an end. And so ultimately, that's going to be the successful play that we're going to go into. Now, these people, these Sky News reporter and other reporters and others that on American television, they hear ad nauseum this claim that Russia is losing 1,000 to 1,500 men per day. Trump says it all the time. You know, 7,000 they lost in the last week, 7,000 killed. And Sirsky again repeats that statement here. So they say, okay, well, you're trying to ground down the Russian and they're losing 1,000 to 1,500 killed per day. It's a crazy number. Man, those Russians just throw bodies away, this meat wave attacks that you used to hear a lot about. Well, they must be still doing them then, because that's what they say. All these casualties coming in. And then in terms of this long range fires, there's a lot of video where they've shown recently, legitimate, straight up, honest, where the Ukraine side launched something deep and they hit an oil refinery somewhere in Russia or some other factory of some sort. These huge flames flying up everywhere. And he's like, wow, that's actually true. So people can go, okay, well, that's plausible, because you are causing these casualties and you do hit these things. So maybe it's going to work. I mean, here's the commanding general says he's going to make this stuff happen. People will follow that through. Well, if you know the full scale, though, you know how absurd that is. For example, I don't know why this doesn't ever occur to anybody who's asking these kind of questions on the long-range fires. They don't, first of all, say, yeah, but isn't the Russian side doing that to you on an almost nightly basis? And sometimes 700, 800 in a night, and just, you know, blowing stuff up left and right, all through, hitting your factories, hitting your energy systems, the ability to generate electricity productions, command and control center, you know, ad infinitum, all these things, all the way throughout the whole country. And I mean, all the way to the western border. Don't y'all do that? Don't the Russians do that to y'all all the time? And you haven't been knocked out of the war. It hasn't stopped you from doing it. And we know that you have just a small fraction of the amount of ordnance going to the Russian side. So how is it that you survive, but they won't, that you can keep fighting and that they can't, when the ratios are way out of proportion in advantage of the Russian side? No one asked that question. And the obvious answer is you don't. I mean, the Russians have used a lot of here, and then to their credit, The Ukraine side has shown tremendous resilience in being able to survive and to operate under these terrible conditions. But it's just a fraction of what the Russians have, who already has a lot more weapons, ammunition, factories, refineries, et cetera, to use. You haven't even scratched the surface of it. I mean, you've made it inconvenient in a few places. You haven't even made it uncomfortable yet. It's not like in, I think even Kiev periodically will go through periods of time where they can only have 7-8 hours of electricity per day. Nothing even close to that has happened in Russia so far. A few times they've been without power for a short period of time, they've replaced it and moved on. The refining capacity, they've knocked it out in some places and they're rebuilding it in some others, and then they just expand it in some of these other areas so that the net is, you know, they just divert it from one place to another, but there's been no interruption at all in the actual war fighting capabilities. And of course, now let's go to the manpower issue. Why would that reporter have not said, well, okay, you're getting into an attrition warfare, but Russia has tens of millions more people that they could draw. They're not even, other than that one partial mobilization, 300,000, they haven't done a forced mobilization since 2022. You, on the other hand, are a daily stealing people off the streets, and that's not enough. And she could have asked, and oh, by the way, about these desertions, 160,000, I think, so far this year, people that are getting killed and wounded, and you're only getting somewhere between 17 and 20,000 forced mobilization per month, and the casualties you have, that's not enough to offset the, ergo, you're shrinking to some degree every single month. How does that work when the Russians don't even have to do a forced mobilization yet? They're still recruiting enough and they're growing in their size. How does all that work out again? No one asked that question. And it's unfortunate because people will just take it at surface value and then they'll go on believing that. Now, of course, this is not going to change the outcome of the war. This is only going to increase the cost of the Ukraine side to lose. And that's the tragedy of this whole situation. And the last part of this, and I'll give you a bit of a spoiler for Monday's show. She says, but do you have enough resources and troops to actually win this war? You're going to have to tune in Monday to find out because you're not going to want to miss it. Now, there's a couple more I want to talk about was also at the latter part of the week that was real interesting. I'm going to ask Gary to come back on for this. He used to work in the media for a long time before he joined our team. The first one I want to show, Gary, is about Maduro. And if I could just real quickly set up here, of course, we're trying to force Maduro to leave. Allegedly, Maduro was trying to offer some deals to get out, but then apparently, anyway, later this week, he has a couple of videos from out in the open in Caracas and just says, yeah, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep going, etc.
National Defense of Venezuela. China publicly supports Venezuela's right to exercise its sovereignty.
Whew. Wow. Beautiful. If you're going to have somebody on your side, you want China on your side, right, Danny?
And what is this? This was just weird, man. This is just weird. Okay, so here's Maduro. On the one hand, he's talking about, yeah, man, I'm gonna not give in to this imperialism from the United States or whatever. But he's doing this kind of weird stuff, man, and playing a little xylophone and yelling that, yay, dancing on. Danny, what is this all about, man?
Well, Danny, I think they do things a little bit differently in Venezuela. You know, studios are a prime real estate. They actually share this with a daytime game show. So he figured he would use the lights and everything else to his availability and just, you know, create a little show for himself. So I thought it was actually pretty smart marketing on his behalf, right? He's like the Trump of Venezuela. He understands entertainment. He understands how to put on a show. That's what this is all about.
Now I know a friend of mine who left Venezuela, and by the way, Maduro, some of his henchmen literally tried to kill his wife's sister, and they had to flee and just barely escaped with their life. So that's the context with which this friend has told me about him. But he said, you know, that the guy's a joke. He's a clown. And he's not respected by a lot of people, but he has power. And that's just an interesting combination of having this kind of clownship and that kind of life and death power over his people.
Danny, I think he's a little bit of a visionary also. He knows his time is limited. He's playing it out. He's got, I don't know, he's got weddings he could play. He's got events that he could DJ. He's playing it up now, and he'll be ready. People will hire him, right?
Maybe he is setting up his post-industrial capacity for something to come later on. I don't know. Maybe that's what he's doing. I mean, in that video you showed, I think also this past week of the dance-off between Maduro and Trump, and I mean, truly, you're right. I mean, he does kind of follow that same path here. But it's interesting that he was talking about China. China's behind me. So I think that part of his confidence here is that he thinks he has China behind his back. But if you'll put that full screen up there, this is what China actually said. They did mention it, but they said, as to comment on the Venezuela crisis, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Li Xian told reporters that Beijing, quote, opposes any action that violates the purposes and principles of the United Nations Charter or undermines the sovereignty and security of other countries, reiterating previous remarks. And so that's not exactly a ringing endorsement of Venezuela, because honestly, I can't imagine the Chinese wanting to get too comfortable with Venezuela and a guy who's playing the xylophone. That is where we are, folks. I mean, that, and this is what we're talking about, you know, Trump putting military pressure on. We'll see what happens with it. I still hope that somehow that we get sobered up on this and we don't end up going down into Venezuela and we don't try to do a regime change operation. That'll just be a disaster. But in any case, it's not anything in America's interest, and we don't have any legal justification to do so. Yeah. Want to end on one other thing, Gary, and another reason I'm glad you're kind of involved here, because this has to do with the media and personalities. Just a real quick backup. Some number of weeks ago, the Pentagon came out with this new policy that said everybody in the Pentagon press corps is going to have to sign this document where they declare that they will no longer use any secret sources, any unauthorized sources, that they're only going to use official sources from the Pentagon or they can't be in the press corps. Well, nearly all of the major news media said, yeah, pound sand, we're not going to do that. To my surprise, even Fox News said, nope, we're not going to participate that. We will not sign that document. And so they left and they moved out along with primarily all the other major media. So the Pentagon has now filled up those seats with like podcasters and other kinds of alternative media, et cetera. Well, one of them was former Congressman Matt Gaetz. And then we saw this video with Gaetz asking some hard questions.
What percentage of the F-35 are fully mission capable today?
So that's a great question, Matt. And I appreciate you getting after it, because not enough. Not enough. It is the most capable fighter that we have right now. When it flies, you're right. It is the most capable fighter. What we have right now, and you saw last month in the acquisition speech, is a department and leadership that's willing to get after it to challenge industry to produce better.
Yeah, but what percentage of them can fly?
So not enough. Not enough.
So but you just called it our most capable platform, and less than 40% of them, my last review of the Air Force's statements, are fully mission capable. Why is it not failure for a platform to perform at less than 40%
look at his face, Gary,
when it costs $100 million?
He's like, so what, man, in the world?
At it holistically, sure, you can throw out the number.
40%. Wait, let's go back to this question, Danny. It's so good. He asked such a great question. Failure.
Why is it not failure for a platform to perform at less than 40% when it costs $100 million?
So, Matt, looking at it holistically, sure, you can throw out the number 40%. But when you look at Operation Midnight Hammer, Operation Rough Rider,
those weren't F-35 was not delivering the payload on Midnight Hammer.
But they were supporting, right? And so those B-2s wouldn't have gotten there without that.
And Lockheed built them. So Lockheed maintains them. Have they had any consequence for not being able to put more than 40% of them in full mission capability?
Absolutely. Under this administration, under President Trump's administration, they are being held to task. The previous administration, it was a joke.
So what are the consequences?
So the consequences are that...
So listen to these consequences, Danny. These are pretty, pretty demanding consequences.
They're here. They're here in the building each and every day. Contracts are being evaluated and reevaluated. You're right. What you have been pushing is the exact right thing. What you didn't have was an administration that wanted to get after it.
Danny, they're here in the building now. We're watching them. We're over their shoulder watching them. That's the consequences.
Yep, that, buddy, that is some serious consequences. Wait a minute. That's actually good for them. They're in the building, and so they're going to get more contracts, and you don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, come on. There's free lunch. There's a lot of perks that go on with being in the building. You and I both know that. You know that more than anybody.
I did. I was stationed there for almost 3 years, so I know what it's like to be in the building, and I You know, I worked in an acquisition program that Boeing was part of in the Future Combat System. So that's not exactly a good thing, because I saw a lot of those guys exerting some pretty undue pressure on. But, you know, one of the interesting things, Gary, that I saw during that time, and that was in the early 2000s at Fort Bliss, Texas, as part of the Future Combat System, is that you had all these guys in there, and they were trying to make, then it was the Future Combat System was of new robotic ground vehicles, air defense weapons, tanks, and armored personnel carriers, new round of them, et cetera. Well, they were claiming that they would do all these things, and then they weren't doing them. And then when we were putting them in the testing, they didn't perform. And instead of saying, instead of us holding them accountable, we go, oh, how can we hide that from Congress? Because otherwise they may keep our money back. So they pretended like they were working. Now, listen, what they didn't bring up in that F-35 issue right there is there are huge amounts of problems with that aircraft, and it does not perform anywhere near what it was supposed to. And I think it's closer to $200 million, not $100 million a pop, when you took add all the things in there to go together with it. But we're not providing performance up to this point here. And, you know, now then when people have to actually shell out some money, they're given a lot of second and third order thoughts about this.
In that interview, they said by 2030, we hope to have a better performance than 40% into the air.
Guy, yeah, that's astounding. This point, after how many years have things been, you know, an alleged operation, which, by the way, it still never went through its normal testing required testing regimen, so it hasn't even passed a lot of those things, and yet they are in the production phase. Now, I wonder how much those Boeing guys actually in the building are part of that process, because, you know, the money talks, et cetera. But, you know, Gary, you're right. I mean, this guy tries to, like they love to do, oh, Biden, whatever. Yeah. Biden ain't in charge right now. Why is 40% okay, and what are you doing about it? And I didn't hear an answer, did you?
No, of course not. My gosh, no. He was trying to deflect, because Matt was doing such a superb job of prosecuting him, basically, on the spot.
He did. And you could tell he was not expecting that. He thought he was going to get a friendly interview where he could trash on the Biden administration. And, yeah, there's not enough. But, hey, we're doing good stuff now. And then he kept calling him back over and over.
It was excellent.
You've seen Gates do that before. You're from Florida, so maybe you paid a little bit more attention than others.
Yeah. No, listen, whatever. He was on a few different committees. He was expert at peeling the onion on whoever he was asking questions of. Just what you just saw there, he was doing that for years. He's skilled. He's got a law degree. He just, you know, it's in him. It's in his blood. He's the perfect person to go in and peel back looking for the answers.
Yeah, and one wonders, you know, is he going to be invited back into the Pentagon press briefing for another one of those? Or they're going to be a little bit more leery about talking to him, I think.
Well, he signed the contract, Danny, so I don't know. You know, they got to break the contract if they don't want him in the room, I guess.
Well, there's ways they can do that, I suppose.
Yeah, no kidding. There's ways. What are you inferring there, Dan? There's ways.
It's almost as though I'm inferring that they don't want hardball questions, but you know, one also wonders, was that interview watched by other people that were in that group? There was I don't know if you could find it. They posted this picture on their social media, the Pentagon did, earlier this week too, where there was this big, you know, like family picture and everybody was smiling. They were all happy to be there. Because I think that the Pentagon really thought, you know, we'll just fill these seats with whoever we want and they'll all be friendly to us. And then here comes Matt Gaetz saying, no, actually, we're going to ask some hard questions.
Yeah. How satisfying was that to see that, right? To actually see somebody penetrate in and really hold somebody accountable, asking the follow-up questions and not just accepting the, you know, performatory answers that were already calculated to be given. And those calculated answers weren't sufficient.
Yeah, it really was, Gary, because, you know what, I mean, when all of these people and all these news networks did not sign it, and especially when Fox News didn't sign it and they literally left, part of me said, well, good on them. I'm glad that they didn't end up signing that and just going, you know, and submitting and doing it, because obviously the whole point was to restrict what they're reporting. But now I got to say, I mean, still good on them for that, I suppose. But when you're talking about journalistic integrity, he's doing what they should have been doing. They should have been doing that every time. And Gary, it never happens at all. It's either in the White House briefing room or anywhere else. They don't ever ask these hard follow-on questions.
You know, Dan, I think it also points out to the fallacy of how severe that contract that they had to sign anyway, that you could still go in there and ask the right questions. Matt Gaetz just demonstrated that for us. So whatever that contract said, whatever they agreed to, well, you could still go in and probe. And that's exactly what he's doing. And I'm glad that he's in there. Obviously, we're glad that he's in there doing that.
And, you know, I mean, we got to be honest, too. That's one of the reasons for the space for channels like ours to actually grow and for people to come and watch it, because they know that they're going to get the straight skinny here. They know that we're unintimidated and uncompromised. And, man, maybe we need to have Matt Gaetz on our show. He seems to be part of that band, too. But The fact that the mainstream media is not of that category is one of the reasons people are getting sick of watching them and coming to places like us, because we're one of the few places that will tell them the truth.
Yeah, Danny, and on that note, I know you don't blow your horn enough for my taste, so I'm just going to say to everybody, please watch the match, the shootout match between Danny and General Ben Hodges. I'm going to put the link in here. It's something that everyone needs to see. It's Danny at his best, and I guess maybe Ben at his best, too. So make sure you watch the debate that Mario had both of them on for an entire hour, actually. It'll be worth your time.
And I felt good about that, in that obviously we have a difference of opinion. That's why they selected both of us to be on there. But it got a little bit of fireworks toward the end. I don't remember if we have that cut in the micro or not, but it still stayed cordial, and we need more of that. We need people asking hard questions, and that was good that we got a chance to both say what we thought. And now it's up to people to believe it.
Yeah, a lot of people remarked, actually, that it wasn't a shouting fest. It was just the opposite. There was hardly any crosstalk during this debate. So you heard people's arguments all the way through to the very end. That's also what made it so informative, is that there wasn't the interruptions and the name-calling. There was none of that. It was really just his facts against your better facts.
His interpretation of facts, maybe I'll put it that way, and my interpretation of what the reality is on the ground. But I think the time is going to work out well for our side and our viewpoint, and we'll just leave it where we'll leave it there, and up to people to make their own decisions.
Amen.
That's one of the things we love about this. But that's our show for today. Really appreciate you guys coming on today. We're going to have another good lineup next week, but also want to remind you, coming up Monday, man, you don't want to miss that show about General Sersky, because if you want to know where they base their fallacies and their literal life and death decisions on how they interpret reality on the ground, you'll never get a better one-shot explanation than you will on that one. So we'll have that for you on Monday. And otherwise, that's it for me and Gary here today, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.
Amen.